You got it all wrong. The issue here ain't pussy. The issue here is monkey. What? Us. We are the monkey.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Let's move on.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them. We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 6, featuring Voodoo, Wise Guy, Smuggler, Plato, and Hero. Hello, everybody.
So,
hey.
Hey, guys.
I'd like to welcome Wise Guy back to the show because Ernie Hancock substituted for him last week on Episode 5. Let's kick it off with a question for Smuggler. It looks like GM is heading for bankruptcy a second time. The United States government owns 500 million shares in GM, which is 26% of the company. And they purchased them through an Obama deal for $16.5 billion in 2010, and now they're worth $10.1 billion. And to add insult to injury, it doesn't look like it's going to get much better because GM's cars are now crap. As Car Driver reports, GM's 2012 Malibu is the worst among the current generation of family sedans, and it even did worse than GM's 2008 Malibu. So, Smuggler, is this just the natural result of what happens when you trust your government with your money? Are all governments this bad at business, or is America, like, an exception?
Yes.
I thought so. I thought it might be. But I wanted to hear you confirm it.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was the short version. The long version, of course, is if you want to make sure that your money is wasted, give it to some gold digger or give it to the government. It will be gone. Are all governments bad at business? Yes, they have to be. In all kinds of business, they are not government. Governments are pretty good in coercion and war and stuff like that. They really master that market. But doing something useful for, you know, humanity and doing stuff people really want to buy, that's something governments cannot do. They cannot do it simply because they're not in a market where price signals work and where private property exists that allows them to make good choices. So yes, all governments are bad in business, but some are less bad than others. I mean, I have heard that they're actually profitable investments made by my government, but to me it seems like an accident. I'll give you one billion examples how government wastes money. And that is the new international airport at Berlin, Germany. They started out saying this thing will cost something like 300 million euros, and it will be done in 2011, early 2011. It's 2012 now, it costs 1.5 billion euros, and it won't be done till at least 2013. So that is a very typical thing on how government does business.
All right. Socialists would disagree with you, though, because they would say that it's a whole lot simpler if we just have this one central government that's in charge of, you know, taking care of everything than trying to have a million people interface together. And you said it's because we need a market and property, which I happen to agree with. But for somebody who isn't schooled in economics, why is a government, a single person or a single entity, so much worse than a million people competing?
There are two general answers to that. Answer number one is that on the market, and the market is everyone, you know, it's all people, not just people with a lot of money, but also people with little money and so on. On the market, nobody has all information. We don't know exactly who wants to buy what. And the process of the market, which means all voluntary interactions between all the parties on the market, they form something like a short living but spontaneous order, and it will, you know, move to the next order, next order, next order. So it's not really static. And nobody really knows why it works, or at least why a specific part of the market works, because it's many people agreeing. But government never has all the information. So it cannot really make the good decisions, especially because those informations, they always change. You know, every minute or something, people change their mind and want to buy something else. So having a static, monolithic decision-making complex there doesn't give you shit. It just fails. You will have a lot of things that nobody needs, and you will have nothing of what people want. And just go to the East, you know, East Germany, US, the Soviet Reich, and whatever. They're prime examples of that. The other reason is that without private property, you never really know how much you're willing to give up to buy something else. You know, if you're just thinking about how much would you pay for a laptop, if you don't have any money, this decision is inconsequential. So only if you have private property, a certain scarcity, you're able to make good decisions on how much you want to pay. And that's the basics of it. It's the Hayek argument against socialism and the Mises argument against socialism.
I would say that there's another aspect, and that is that even though in the West, where private property is touted the most, in reality, there's major types of private property that you never really own. For example, no one really owns their home. It doesn't matter whether you've paid off the mortgage. Try not paying your taxes and see what happens to your home ownership.
Yeah, and stories like this really bring out the central planner and the people who are writing the stories for the newspapers. Is it the Malibu that's bringing down GM? Who knows? Maybe it's the SUVs. The SUVs are now subject to CAFE standards where they weren't before. So GM's having to make one full-size truck that has the engine that people want to buy, and then another size truck that gets the fuel mileage that Obama wants. So they're making a whole line of trucks that are just for Obama, you know. But that's the central planning, and that's completely beside the point. This should be the least surprising news ever. Back when the auto bailouts occurred, GM, the markets and mismanagement had both spoken, and they said, GM, you are in control of resources, that's labor and buildings and capital equipment, that is misallocated. And how do we know that? Because GM was facing bankruptcy. Would GM have gone out of business? No, they would have been reorganized. They could have sold off some of those assets, some of those resources. Those resources could have been reused by somebody to make, I don't know, better engines, which no one's even attempting to make better engines right now. They could have been used to make different types of vehicles, you know, safer vehicles, smaller vehicles, whatever kind of vehicles would fit the niche markets, you know, produce something that people wanted to buy. But because the bailouts occurred, those resources, the misallocation of resources got persisted. So of course they're going to face bankruptcy again. They still have all those resources on their books that shouldn't be there. They should be in other hands producing other things.
So that makes me think of a couple of Wikipedia articles. There's one, Economies of Scale, and there's one, Diseconomies of Scale. And the gist of those is saying that as you grow a company bigger and bigger, there's advantages to having a lot of people. You know, you can do a lot of stuff. But eventually, you get so big that the internal friction, like getting all the emails to be routed through the HR department to the right guy and complying with all the managers and like all that structure, it has costs. So there's some optimal size of a business. And this makes me think of a Coinbase episode that Hiro and I did, because this new company called Wikispeed, they have a website, wikispeed.com. They're building a car and they're offering you a prototype for $25,000, and they claim it's designed to get 100 miles to the gallon. That's their simulated results. And they'll knock 3% of the price off if you use Bitcoin. And they're using an agile development process, so they keep iterating their design, and when they find a problem, they, you know, revise the part and bolt the part on. It's all modular, so they don't have to redesign the whole chassis. And this seems like a way, like, better way for the manufacturers to get rich than GM, you know, offering a 2012 Malibu that's worse than a 2008 Malibu.
Yeah, but you cannot do that with a company where you have thousands of old-time blue-chip investors in there. They don't get it. They want projections, they want security, they want a model line. And that simply doesn't work anymore. So it's not just the size of the company, but it's also the number of investors you have and how many of those investors really have anything to do with a business. And with companies like GM, most investors have no clue about the automobile business.
I would like to add in here to the comments that Smuggler made and Voodoo made on the economics. One of the things that Smuggler said was that when you don't have the money, your decision is a little bit warped compared to someone who is thinking about what do they have to give up in order to get this. This is another huge problem, is that also if you have too much money, the actual allocation of resources also gets distorted, because if you go in to buy a car and you're thinking that, oh, it's going to cost me $20,000 for this car, and you're thinking, I have these gold coins over here and I'm going to have to sell a majority of your coins, gold coins, in order to get this car, you know, you're going to start, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to go like do something else. Whereas if you can go in and just sign your name on a piece of paper with a financing company who is possibly even a lot of these car companies have their own internal financing companies that are tied in with banks, and it goes all the way up to the amount of money that's available from the Federal Reserve. So as the interest rates are manipulated and the amount of credit then is manipulated, then people get easy loans, which it gives them much more flippant decisions on how they're going to actually spend that money, and then that causes a massive distortion in the entire system of automobile manufacturers.
Sure. I know I didn't really understand the magnitude of my student loans when I took them out. It's just numbers, right?
Well, I think that the interest rates affect every aspect of the economy, and most people really aren't aware of it on a personal basis unless they're going to make a major purchase. And credit comes before capital in banks, so and the currency. And it's not like most people look at these, fractional reserve systems, and they just look at how much money is generated from deposits. But actually, the credit precedes the deposits. And this kind of round robin situation, a feedback loop, makes it difficult for most people in their personal lives to understand what's going on, and even most of the economists.
Well, except if you start to do the old-time thing that the Puritans did, and that is only spend the money you have in your hand.
Well, I mean, that's what we're going to have to do if this financial structure collapses, because none of the investments are going to be worth anything anymore. I mean, all the pension funds have just invested into hedge funds, and the hedge funds, we just found out last week, according to a judicial ruling, if they mismanage clients' money and lose it, the client's just screwed. The hedge fund has to pay back the banks that it owes money before it can pay back the customers whose money it lost.
Well, the hedge funds in the United States, almost all of them, have used an actuarial base of about 7.5% to 8.5% of return per annum. Clearly, 2 or 3% is about the maximum that one can achieve in today's market without taking extreme risks. And this is why one of the reasons the stock market has been pumped up, because there's no way for the hedge funds to achieve their rate of return and satisfy the pensioners unless they get that return.
Sure. So, yeah, I saw that only like 20% of the hedge funds this year were even beating the Standard & Poor's 500. So it's not a good day to be investing in hedge funds. Anyway, let's move on to predicting location with cell phone data. A researcher named Mirko Musilesi says that he's made an algorithm that can predict where individuals will be by collating information from their phones, like GPS data, telephone numbers, texts, and calls. So he's got these inputs, and he puts them into some crazy genetic algorithm or something, and he correlates it all together, and he figures out these macro patterns of, like, who's going where in the city and who are they interacting with. Here's a quote from Forbes. Crucially, the algorithm was only precise to 20 square meters when it also tracked the movements and data of each volunteer's friends. When the algorithm was simply tracking the volunteer, it could predict their future GPS coordinates to roughly within 1,000 square meters. When the prediction took into account additional information from a single friend, the error rate improved by several orders of magnitude. So, this is kind of scary to me because he doesn't need specialized equipment. He needs a smartphone with a GPS chip and a cell phone carrier who is willing to give him the data. And as we discussed in a prior episode, the cell phone companies are more than willing to hand over all the data they have as long as, you know, the right paperwork is filed. So, Voodoo, are we screwed even if we pull out our SIM cards from our phones and just use a Wi-Fi mesh?
No. This is a non-story. Basically, what the researcher found is that if you know where somebody's girlfriend is and where their best friend is, you can predict where they're going to be. Duh. Okay. He went immediately to, oh, this could be used to stop crime, and we could use this algorithm to predict where somebody's going to be and where crime's going to happen. The problem is that you have to, before the fact, establish correlations between other people's data, cell phone data, and the target's cell phone data. So, this goes back to all these surveillance systems. You have to walk the cat back, as they say, and see in the past what's this person's relation been to their friend's data. I don't think it's something that's going to be very helpful to law enforcement or to anyone at all in sort of a privacy invasion, because you're just not going to have all that data. You don't have that historical data that we know of. You don't have the correlations pre-built for everybody, the network pre-built for everybody. I just don't see it as being a big story.
So the scary part is when Trapwire gets linked into the data from the cell networks. So I guess that's when we panic.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. Because then you can look back in history and develop networks on a target, and then you could correlate where they are. So this algorithm is actually, it's an interesting bit of correlation, and I think it does have something. I think people who are interested in tradecraft should pay attention to the algorithm. And, if you're setting up networks, if you are working with people and it's something that you don't want to be predicted, this is a good example of the type of things that will give you away, I guess is the way to put it.
Did you see that in the same article, it says that Facebook uses algorithms to identify shifty users? For instance, looking for older males who chat with young girls using the words like sex and date. So recently, Facebook tipped off the cops when a guy started chatting with an underage girl and arranged to meet her, and cops moved in and arrested him. So that just kind of caught my eye because it's, another example of the private sector collaborating with the public sector to enforce coercion and tyranny. I mean, obviously not in this exact case of some pedo going after an underage girl. But if they're willing to do it for that, they're willing to do it for, somebody who texts his friend through Facebook saying, hey, can I buy a gram of pot? It's a slippery slope.
I just wanted to add something, and that is there are two different kinds of analytics at work here. With Facebook's, they know exactly what characteristics they're looking for. Old guy, young girl, and certain words that hint at a certain, content. With the cell phone prediction thing, that's it's a different thing. What they're doing is they essentially have a heat map algorithm for predicting regular behavior and correlated behavior. And no, you don't actually have to model all the networks and all the behaviors to the past. This thing learns alone. And we have lots of those prediction algorithms at work already. And they do actually have a scary potential. And that scary potential is police doesn't have to look for you anymore, but they're just using the movements of your friends. Even if your telephone is switched off, they will use the movement of your friends to find out where you are.
I guess it's good not to have many friends or none.
Or no phones, nowhere.
And they have to previously know that these people are your friends. They can't do it on the fly.
Yeah, but you know that from the calling records already. So essentially, all the data you have already in the cell phone network.
So the only way is to just assume another identity, get new friends, and don't use a mobile phone.
Well, don't use a mobile phone is a pretty good thing. And the other thing is only do communication that is anonymous. There's no easy to get traffic data on who's calling whom and who's talking with whom. So those are the two minimum things you should do.
I think this brings up one of the topics that I'm hoping we'll cover in a future episode, which is using new types of radio communications that allow people to clandestinely communicate where only the endpoints can identify one another, their locations, their timing, etc.
That would be fun to get into. With the cell phones, though, if I'm not mistaken, you can identify, or well, a carrier can identify those even without a SIM card, right? Because a tower can still be talking to the cell phone and get some number, IMEI perhaps, and that's the unique identifier for the phone. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. That is exactly what they can do. So actually, if you don't have GPS, that doesn't help because the cell itself is traceable. The cell is the location in which you are. It's a logical and physical place, so to speak, for communication. And yes, every phone comes with a globally unique number that is available to the network, even if you don't have a SIM card.
However, there are electronic countermeasures that can be used with phones, although I don't think much tradecraft has been devoted to that. If you're able to exclude all of the cell phones in your area, all of the towers, that is, I should say, in the area, except one of the ones that you're talking to, by using proper antenna technology, then they only know the circle around that cell tower in the sector where you are, and they can't triangulate your position.
That's not really true, because modern cell towers, they use array antennas, and it's not like you have the tower in the middle and a circle around it. But it's more like a cake, and you have a slice of cake that is covered by one antenna, and the antenna actually knows more or less the distance by measuring the radio strength and the radio latency.
Yes, they know the distance from the antenna, and then the sector, which is usually 60 to 120 degrees, gives them, you know, sort of a segment that you're on.
Which in a small cell, like in populated areas, is not that much space. It's like a block.
It would, if somebody was tracking those IMEIs, it would really throw them off if you set up some system where you had a community, say, I don't know, 100 people, and they're all exchanging their cell phones all the time. Like, you know, I don't know, you wouldn't be able to correlate the IMEIs to each person, and since the phones would be moving around, they'd lose that channel.
Yeah, it's actually a good idea to have a cell phone swap party. Essentially, bring your cell phone, have a SIM card with a prepaid agreement on there, have no money on the prepaid, and then just swap phones, you know, throw them into a bag and everyone draws a new phone. And you do that every week, and you really screw up some data banks there.
Well, the cypherpunks used to do that with the cards for groceries in a small scale. At their meetings, their physical meetings in the on the West Coast, they would swap their cards first thing. There's also another technology that can work, which is to have throwaway phones and put them back-to-back with one another. Connect them in such a way as you make your call to the mobile phone through a second phone, and then they have to find that second phone to figure out which one you were talking through.
Actually, that is so 80s. You know, today we have voice over IP. So you actually have your back-to-back phones with multiple voice over IP channels and then peer them to real phones.
Even better.
Oh, man, I have like a cypherpunk hard on right now. All right, so we've talked about Tripwire for the past couple episodes, and the rabbit hole has not ended yet. We're still falling down it. Here's just a few of the things that have turned up recently. It's being used to track anarchists and political dissidents at Occupy Oakland. this Cubic Corporation purchased Trapwire and then issued a public statement saying, hey, well, we have absolutely nothing to do with that. Our purchase was totally unrelated. New York Times uploaded a story and removed it. This is getting complicated, and I think that's kind of a hallmark of this cyber-industrial complex. If you have a whole lot of secrets and 1,000 companies that are all, you know, totally interlocked with each other, it's damn near impossible to really understand a story and understand the players involved and figure it out. So, Wise Guy, maybe you can give me some ideas. What would you do to like try to filter out the good info from the bad info on all this Trapwire stuff?
Well, that's an excellent question. In the past, you could count on eventually the truth coming out through people that either let it slip or became whistleblowers. And I think we'll probably still have some of that. But it seems that the Trapwire information mostly got into the press as a result of the penetration by Anonymous of one of the companies that was involved in the cyber industrial complex. And when that information leaked, it sort of set off a chain of events, including a DDoS attack on WikiLeaks. And so I think now many people in the major media are being very quiet because they don't want to attract the lightning that might come from the NSA, the CIA, and the domestic intelligence agencies. But as far as getting to the truth of what's going on and what's shilled and what's bad info, I think it's going to take some more penetrations by Anonymous and some others to get the enough information out to separate the wheat from the chaff.
And just looking at these companies, you know, Cubic can say all day long that these are separate companies and Abraxas is not Intrepid, is not Dauntless, is not Trapwire. But look at their corporate filings. It's the exact same people and they're all CIA spooks. The CIA cannot do domestic spying. So what do? We set up a sock puppet corporation using our own guys and fund it through DHS and DOD money. That's all this is. But the scary part is that document from Intrepid showing anarchist networks. In this case, this is proof. This is their own marketing material saying we are targeting political ideologies. You know, whether you agree with anarchism, whether you know about anarchism, anarchism is a valid political ideology with a long and philosophical history. And to target people who hold that political philosophy and then label them as terrorists in your marketing materials, there's something that's not being told on this whole story. There's something, the fact that the New York Times story goes away, the fact that Australian news stories went away on it, there's something that somebody's scared of. They don't want Trapwire in the news right now. And whether it might be as simple as the DNC and RNC using it to protect their conventions, but it's something very strange. And then the New York Times comes out today, and they've got a story on that total information awareness is still going. So why would they pull a story on Trapwire but allow the story on total information awareness to play? I'm not understanding. I think we're missing a huge chunk of the puzzle. And when it comes out, I think it's going to be a barn burner. Obviously, it has to be, or they'd be scared. But for the life of me, I can't figure out what it is. I mean, we've gone through bank bailouts and auto bailouts and election fraud, and Obama and Bush have been arming the cartels, and we've had all these police state tactics, and coordinated crackdowns on the Occupy camps and everything, and yet these are things to me people should have been out on the streets for, but they didn't go out on the streets. So if they're worried about something, and there was a lot of stories this week also about how governments are scared of their subjects, if they're scared about something, it's got to be something gigantic. And I think people should just keep watching this story and be looking out for where they were manipulated by this system somehow to act against their own interests.
I think a big thing on the whole subject here is simply that it's too complex and too confused to put into a single good and well-researched press release or something like that. I mean, we have several dozen companies involved. We have several dozen people involved. We have products with very limited information about what those products really do, and stuff like that. So essentially what we're doing right now is stabbing at a cloud, you know, and not really knowing what we see, except that we don't like the cloud as a total, so to speak. And there's a lot of misinformation, whatever. And that also touches the standard news media. I mean, they have to be careful because they can be easily sued because these are private companies. They will easily sue the New York Times for whatever damages if the New York Times has not enough research in their stories.
Well, that's a good point. About 2 years ago, or maybe perhaps three, there was an interview on NPR with an author who released a book that was targeting these kinds of systems. That is talking about the, you know, information awareness systems. One of the things that he said is when the TIA or Total Information Awareness Group was disbanded, that was the one that was led by Admiral John Poindexter. He said that all of the functions of that organization were absorbed into other places, mostly in the NSA, except for one aspect. When Poindexter was running the operation, he insisted that the information be made stored in such a way so that the analysts could not identify individuals that were being targeted, that, you know, it hid that information from them. Whereas when the NSA and the other organizations absorbed the total information awareness function, they removed that so that all of the information was out there and the identity of the people being tracked, monitored, etc.
I think that, and the other thing that's really important to understand with the whole story is that it is really about getting out of regulation here. Like Weisgerber already said on total information awareness, you split it up, you let a few things drop that, you know, hinder you in your work, and that is progress, so to speak. With TrackWire, we're looking at something that is more global, that's held by private interests, that is distributed probably over another two dozen companies that we have no idea about, that are not based in the U.S., that do not have to keep any laws, so to speak, at least not as a network of companies. So the real thing here is that this is not one government running a surveillance network, but it's a network of companies and a network of governments cooperating to run a global network that is totally outside of any accountability and control.
So what can people within those societies do? The political process will probably not interfere with these organizations if history is a judge. What can be done to interfere with these tracking systems and these data collection systems?
Well, I, for one, would rather be somewhere that doesn't have the cameras. I mean, that seems to me the simplest answer. Move somewhere that you're not being as heavily tracked.
Yeah, except that there are so many things that track us. It's not just the cameras. You know, it's the mobile phones.
Sure,
it's
the license
internet.
Plate readers, they'll know where I go.
Exactly. The list is endless, so to speak. So in my opinion, either you live with it or you develop methods of not giving out too much data. You know, like the cell phone swapping networks, like covering your face. Like, you know, rental cars under a pseudonym or whatever. So essentially, I think it's about tradecraft or giving up. You know, either we get extreme with reclaiming our privacy, or we have lost forever.
I would like to add something to that also, is that if you look at this as a global type operation, like the U.S. military or some other like global empire military, you can sit there and say, well, you know, how do we escape being occupied by a foreign military if you're in another country and all this stuff. Well, you get back to some of the core principles of counter economics and agorist ideas. One of those is you can eliminate some of these things through defunding. Okay, so you're not going to be able to fight a global empire military. You're not going to be able to escape from its clutches, and you may be able to use some type of techniques to like protect yourself and everything like that, but ultimately